Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the lean to my fat back, it's Dan. How are you doing this evening, Dan?
Yeah, my legs are a little tender from a big hike today, but other than that, they're not that bad, considering what I've been doing lately. So, how are you doing?
I've had a fairly miserable evening. long story, mercifully short for our listeners. I came home to discover that, much as it did once last year, the thermostat in my house was on the fritz, and it was a nice and moist 91 degrees when I walked in the house, which also affects the people who live above and below me, or at least the kitty cats who live above and below me. So over the next couple hours, people were here trying to figure out how to fix the wiring. We didn't know what the heck to do. And it was one of those magical things where, wait, it's been disconnected, but it's still running, and, you know, like a smoke detector or something. But within about 2.5 hours, it looks like we have sort of fixed it. So the temperature is slowly dropping in the house. Last I checked, it was around 80, I think it was 85 or maybe 84 degrees at this point. So if there happens to be a little bit more background noise or static or whatever the sound might be on my audio here, that's because I've kind of yanked open all the windows and I have fans running all over the place, because otherwise I'd be just a sweaty puddle during this podcast, which would not be a good idea. Also why I do not plan to drink any alcohol during this podcast, because that will just dehydrate me further and then I'd probably pass out during it, which would maybe make podcasting history, but I don't think I want to do that.
Well, hopefully with the windows open, the dog will have a chance to contribute, because it's been quiet for a while.
Oh, yeah. It's about 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time here in New York. So that dog starts to perk up when he's going to bark, usually in about a half an hour, 45 minutes. So we'll see if that
happens. Oh, nice.
Let's hope not. Actually, I usually am not even aware of it because I have the headphones on. You usually will pick it up more than I do. Anywho, as folks will know, as those who've already clicked on this podcast or downloaded it, we are here once again to talk about the latest episode of Fargo. Although our original plan was to do these within an hour or two of the episode airing, like, as always, real life does kind of impact our little podcast here, so we have delayed it by a day, which really doesn't matter. It gave me a little bit more time to, you know, write the notes with a bit more of a flourish, even though I spent way too long on them anyway. Huh. Funny thing about this new DVR of mine, when you watch a program that you've recorded, it's so advanced in all these other ways. It can tape six things at the same time. It's really nice. But it doesn't give you any sort of a counter or anything that you normally would have to see where you are in an episode. Like if you're watching an hour episode, you don't know if you're 20 minutes into it or 40 minutes into it, unless you've just been paying attention. So I'm doing the notes and watching this episode in the wee hours Monday night, because I got delayed. And I'm doing it really late at night. It's like, it's 3, it's 3:30, it's 3:45 in the morning. And I'm loving the episode. Once again, great episode. And I have no issue with it at all. Content, pacing, what have you. But I got to be honest, there was part of it that kept going, oh, please let this be the final act, because it's so late. No one told me, and I had no way of knowing, this was a really long episode. You know? I think it was like an hour and a half or something. This was not like an hour episode. I had no idea. So I didn't finish writing my notes until 4:15 in the morning. I imagine, therefore, by the time we get towards the end of the recap, the quality of the words I choose may be somewhat lacking. Might be man looks at camera end or something. Me sleep. So I guess instead of wasting any more time, since who knows, this may be a slightly longer podcast. I hope not, but we'll see. I guess I should get right into the recap. Want me to get to it then, sir?
Yep.
Okay. So we are talking about Fargo in the latest episode, which was Before the Law. This one was written and directed by Noah Hawley. I think I may be mistaken, but I believe this might have been the fellow's directing debut. I didn't see any other directing credits for him on IMDb when I looked it up. So that's kind of interesting. It's the creator's first time directing. And if this is his first time directing, that's something.
I'm pretty sure it is. And that's funny, too, because like, even before I realized that, I'm just like, wow, the direction in this episode is really nice. You know, just the way they had everything shot up and that opening montage, you know, split screen thingamabobber, the way that they were shooting stuff is really, really nice. So, I guess he knows what he's doing, at least. I mean, of course, the crew knows what they're doing, too, so that probably helps some, but he didn't fuck it up.
Right, which is, you know, key. If you're going to direct, don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, we start off with a bit, I would say like a mini montage, because we get to see several characters. I mean, we cover a lot of bases here. We see Sheriff Larson, which is Ted Danson, Floyd Gerhardt, that's Gene Smart, Lou Salverson's wife, Betsy, the Blomquist, which are Kirsten Dunst and Jesse
Clemens.
I always want to call him Clemens. I know it's Clemens. I don't know why I screwed it up all the time. And they've got this old Bobby Gentry song in the background. What I liked about this, number one, it was a very brief montage, unlike certain other FX shows that we always seem to rag on over the last couple of years. And that's all we'll say about that.
No, it's not. My boss texted me like 2 hours ago. He's like, hey, do you got season 7 of Sons of Anarchy on Blu-ray? I'm just like, fuck no. That was like one of the worst seasons of TV I've ever seen. I'm sorry, but I don't.
Okay. Well, kind of lost my, you kind of derailed me what I was trying to say there. The montage. What I really liked about the montage is that there was a little spine going throughout the whole thing. And we're following this car, which I spent way too long on Google to figure out what car it was. I don't know why I do things like that. But it was an Oldsmobile 98 with Missouri plates. It's driving down the road. And we see that the main passengers are, again, Joe Bulo. That's the Brad Garrett character. And this other person was a character that we only really saw in the background of that final scene last week. The character that we'll later learn his name is Mike Milligan. It's played by the actor Bukim Woodbine, who I've seen many, many times. He always brings the goods. Another one of those actors is really, he's good at playing smooth-talking menace, is how I phrase it. And I really did just come up with that on the fly. That was not in my notes. Anyway, so these two, they're escorted by these two large and imposing twins who are both wearing like hats and matching beards. And they arrive at the Gerhardt compound. And I like this little thing that they do where, you know, the doors to the big house are swung open and we push in. And ever so slightly, we see the man who was once the strong patriarch of this family, but now he's just enfeebled sitting in a chair. We see Otto all the way sitting in the back in this little room. I kind of like the way they did that, almost showing how small he's kind of become in a weird way, you know?
Yeah, I'm just glad he's still alive. I'm sure they won't have him do much, but you know, it's good to see Colonel Ty holding in there for a bit, hopefully getting a paycheck.
And I will admit that I had assumed that he had actually had passed away in the previous episode, or at least that was how I remembered it. So
I thought he was still alive, but I just didn't want to argue with you the entire podcast, so I'm just like, yeah, fuck it.
Now we have other podcasts to do all the arguing.
In real life.
In real life, oh lordy. So then we're back to Floyd, and again, for anyone who hasn't picked up on it, that's the Gene Smart character. Oh, by the way, who knew, those of us who are a little bit older, that when we watched a show like Designing Women back in the 80s, that this actress, who was not really among the standouts on that show at the time, when people remember Designing Women, they tend to talk more about like Dixie Carter or even Delta Burke. Gene Smart tends to be one of the least remembered of the quartet on that show. And now we've seen her, the dramatic work she's done on shows like 24 and what we see her on this, she's a very talented woman. I'm very impressed with her. Just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, me too. I've only seen her. Well, everything I've seen her in has been good. So she really, you know, really elevated that season of 24, man.
Absolutely. So she's busy counting money, which is for some sort of disbursement to their peeps. with a character I don't think we'd met before, Charlie, who I believe is her grandson. I think this money that they're counting, I could be wrong about this, as I've been before. I got the impression that this money, to some extent, might have been tributes or gifts, almost like get-well cards based on what had happened to her husband. Yeah. I didn't know if it was just their regular money. I thought it was – that's how it felt to me. Did you get that impression as well?
Yeah, something like that. You know, not like a – you know, like they did a fundraiser type thing, but it was more of just like a – you know, like all the people that pay protection to them, like, coughed up, like, extra money just for the heck of it.
It felt very much like a mob kind of thing to do. And since they are kind of – that's kind of the kind of business they're in, it made sense. One thing that should be mentioned about Charlie, he has some form of cerebral palsy because you can see that his hands are kind of twisted and afflicted with it as he's looking through the envelopes. Anyway, someone comes into the room, whispers into Floyd's ear, and then she sends her grandson off to summon the family back to the house. Now, first he goes to get Bear, who's played by Angus Sampson, who's busy sharpening his axe, which I like that because I just feel at some point or another, we're going to see that axe being used. You don't go through the trouble showing a character sharpening an axe without it being used. I was amazed it wasn't used in this episode. Correct me if I'm wrong, is he Charlie's dad? Because the way he was speaking to him, it sounded like the way a father speaks to his son. Is that what you thought?
I believe so. I'm not positive because I was having trouble keeping track of, you know, who is what there, but...
Well, my impression is she has three sons, one of whom we all know is already dead and would be too young to have a kid like that. And I know he's not Dodd's son because we meet Dodd's child, you know, a few minutes later. So, and I think he says something to him. I don't know if it was about homework or something about chores, which sounded like the kind of thing a father would say, not like an uncle. So, again, could easily be proven wrong, but it seemed to me like he was a son. Anyway, then Charlie goes to the barn to retrieve Dodd, who's busy telling a little story to some man that he's just maimed and tortured, apparently to death. I would presume with the assistance of his right-hand man there, Hansy, this whole thing was, first of all, initially it was reminiscent of Reservoir Dogs, which itself is actually a reference or... an homage to the severed ear in Blue Velvet, because this guy, he's got both his ears cut off and tossed in a nearby bucket. So that was something to see. And of course, when they leave the barn, a German Shepherd, I guess he decides it's a better bucket than to get KFC or something, and he has himself an eerie little snack. I deserve to be beaten upside the head for that one. Anyway, once again, I just need to point out what Jeffrey Donovan is doing here, and this comes from me watching him for several years on Burn Notice. He's having so much fun with this character. He's definitely one of the more colorful characters of the season so far. You know, he's just the way he wears that hat. He's got that little nub of a cigar wedged in his mouth. And we know he's got a tendency for violence, even just based on these two episodes, even though we haven't seen him do very much, but... you know he's going to bring it eventually. I like that for really no reason. He flicks that cigar stub at those twin bearded guys by the car, which kind of makes them react. And as he and his brother are heading into the house, we see that Joe and Mike are walking out of the house. So the family, they meet in the kitchen, you know, Dodd asks who the goons were, and Mom lets them know that they're from Kansas City and that they want to buy us out. Now, this whole scene is really about Dodd. You know, pretty much he instantly wants to go to war, despite his mother telling him, you know, it's a new world out there. You know, it's more of a corporate world as far as crime is concerned. There's really no room for a family business in it anymore. And also, I want to again reiterate, because I wasn't expecting there to be this character in this, that Dodd apparently has a teenage daughter. She's at least teenage there, I guess. I'm just pointing her out because I figure if you have a character like that in this, she's probably going to be important at some point in the story. You know, I just assume that's going to happen with her.
Right.
But the essence of the scene is a power struggle between mother and son, because she makes it clear that their father is unlikely to ever regain control, you know, of his faculties after his stroke. So just as they were talking at the end of last episode, well, someone's going to have to ascend to the throne here. So Dodd, being the oldest son, he naturally thinks it should be him. But Bear, to his credit, thinks that their mother is the logical choice. And clearly she does as well. I had to say right here, I was really appreciative of the fact that based on appearances, I initially would have assumed that Bear was going to be not that smart a guy. But listening to him speak is like, no, he seems fairly sharp. We haven't seen him be a dumb guy yet. You know, So I like that they didn't go quite the cliched route I was expecting them to with that character. I mean, I could be proven wrong again in a later episode, but right now he seems to have a level head on his shoulders.
Yeah, he kind of reminded me of like the older Bennett brother on a second season of Justified.
Oh, good memory for that one. I forgot all about him. So they clear the room, and it's just Dodd and Floyd sitting down. She keeps insisting, I remember this, that he eats something because, you know, she's a mother. But she makes it clear that this is not his time. It's not his time to take over the business. But really, I think she just wants him to let her guide them through what's going to be obviously a very hard time for the family. It just may only take a few weeks, but eventually she will hand this legacy over to him. But he just has to be patient. Right now what's important to her is finding Rye, who we all know was killed off in the last episode, but none of these folks know it as of yet. I kind of like there's this ever... The show has already given us at least one or two different kind of... for lack of a better way to put it, ticking bombs. You're just waiting for people to find out about certain things and what impact that's going to have. And in this story, especially when we get to the end of this episode, when people find out that it's Rye who's dead, that's going to have some rather major consequences. And I'm betting there's going to be some assumptions that are incorrect that are made as a result of it. Back to that Oldsmobile. That's right. I'm going to call it what the car really is. Bulow and Milligan are talking about what they think the Gerhardts are going to actually do. So basically, Bulow doesn't think surrender is going to come easily to an old family business like the Gerhardts. And then there's this really weird and funny moment that Mike Milligan tries to make some weird analogy between the sons and the different types of claws of a lobster. Which really only results in Bulow getting like really exasperated and not even wanting an explanation for what he calls his fakakta metaphor. Which, oh, by the way, I just loved hearing that because I don't know if Joe Bulow is supposed to be Jewish, but him using a Yiddish phrase kind of made me laugh there. But that was an interesting kind of a character introduction because that's the first, you know, thing we're really hearing this character say, and it's a very weird, wait, what? Lobster analogy. But the important thing is that Joe believes that in the end, they're going to make a deal with one of the sons, and in any case, either a deal is going to get cut or bodies are just going to go to the morgue. You know, they're going to take over the business one way or the other. Oh, one more thing. It's interesting he refers to his bosses as the Krauts. You know, so I guess they're of German origin. Again, interesting because, you know, him using Yiddish before, that he might actually be Jewish himself. And thinking about the show, and I'm looking at all the different character names, it's funny how they're kind of reminding me of the Swedish books, the Dragon Tattoo books. Because there's a lot of names that seem to have in common, like, you know, Sheriff Larson, Stieg Larson, you know, it's spelled in a similar way. Blomqvist is a name of a major character from those books. I think Salverson might actually be a name in those books. I could be wrong about that, or something very similar to it. So I'm wondering if that helped inspire this, or it's just an indication that this region of Minnesota. Is that right?
Yeah, Minnesota is primarily Scandinavian and German, so that's the kind of.
So it makes perfect sense because those kind of people would be there. They would have migrated right. there years and years ago. Mm-hmm. Okay, then it works perfect. But you see what I mean? It reminded me of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So later we're at the Rock County Sheriff's office, and we see that Sheriff Larson is examining that white shoe that he got out of the tree. We then see him at the Salverson home in Luverne, Minnesota. That was interesting. They actually bothered to give us a little title card to let us know that's where he was. I don't think they needed to do that, but I always appreciate being given a hint where we are geographically speaking. So while he's at his, son-in-law and daughter's house, actually, Lou does come down, and we find out that they know that one of the diner victims was a judge out of North Dakota. And, you know, Larson kind of posits it this way. You know, was she just in the wrong place at the wrong time, or was this whole mess about her? Now, speaking of messes, we then switch to that bloody smashed windshield and hood of that Blomquist car in their garage. Now, outside we see Ed, and he's slowly looking through Rye's wallet. You know, and we also see him remembering the moments that he saw Rye in the garage. It was almost done like these little shocking snapshots in his mind or something. At the same time, we also see Peggy is getting ready, and she's having memories of that evening too. She's clearly better at compartmentalization than her husband is, that's for sure. Huh. But we find out while she is going to go to work at the hair salon where she works, he's going to stay home so he can start cleaning up that mess. Now, last time we spoke about her, I think I might have said something regarding what kind of person I was perceiving Peggy to be, largely based on how we saw the events unfold at her home, in their garage, and in those flashbacks. I mean, I didn't go as far as to call her something like a sociopath, but I think I might have noted how disturbing or weird her almost apathetic or downright inexplicable behavior had been. But I feel like I need to note a couple things that were told to me after the fact. One little fact that was actually conveyed to us by one of our fellow seriously geeky podcasters, Jason, a member of our All-Star Squad, he did point out to me that the actual crime or the accident that happened very well could have been based on a real event that happened several years ago when a woman hit a man, I think it might have been a homeless guy, and then she ended up driving for several more miles, or at least a few more miles, with the guy dying and sticking out of her windshield. So that might have been an inspiration for that scene. But probably a bit more importantly, and more to the point of why I brought this up at all, another one of my friends, and I believe actual listeners, or at least his wife is an actual listener, and he'll, you know, walk through the room back and forth, he probably listens. Anyway, you know, it's rare for me to both have a friend and a listener, so it's nice to have both. So he actually had pointed out to me that her actions, which I found so strange, could just as easily have been just the way certain people will react to extreme trauma, that sometimes people feel the need to resume routine, and you busy yourself with, you know, like the minutia of your usual rituals and activities to really kind of forget or put aside what you've just lived through. So that was kind of an interesting perspective I hadn't thought of. Now, I'll confess, even though I didn't read the article, I did see a headline of an article online that was about the series and specifically about Kirsten Dunst, and it looked like she was discussing something about the mentally disturbed state of her character. So I don't know what to believe right now. So, you know, is she, you know, is there really something off with her, or is this just, you know, a byproduct of the trauma? I'm guessing this is just something we'll see unfold over the course of the next few episodes. I mean, even by the end of this episode, I realize that, well, I can't really say she's all that screwy so far. I mean, she's, you know, she seems maybe more like she's dealing with things, albeit maybe in a different fashion than her husband. So, well, getting back to the story, we're with Dodd now, and it's clear he's going to go against his mom. So he makes sure that his that Hansi is going to be with him, and he believes their distributors, you know, the people they deal with all the... Do they establish what it is that, what kind of crime that they're involved in? Is it drugs? Is it prostitution? Is it a whole, is it everything? Do they ever even clarify that?
Yeah, I don't remember. I'm sure they talked about it when they had that, like, PowerPoint presentation or the, whatever the hell.
You're right. It probably did. So I guess we'll just assume it's whatever the norm is for, you know, especially in the late 70s. So it might have been drugs. It might have been, it could have been a whole bunch of things. Probably not all that relevant right this moment, I guess. But much like, there's one thing he does agree with his mom, they need to find Rai. See, I think he thinks Rai will go along with him, which is funny since he didn't get along all that well with Rai at the beginning of the series. But okay, well, I'll go along with that. So it seems like we have all these reasons that we should be on pins and needles waiting for them to find out that Rai is actually dead. Because it's, as the show goes along, you can see it's going to have bigger and bigger ramifications and an impact on things the longer it takes for them to find out about it. Okay, so shortly after that, we see a bus pulling into town and it drops off Peggy. After she pops into the butcher shop, and oh, by the way, there was a really nice little line in the butcher shop. I felt it was funny enough to write it down. Where that's, you know, it's a butcher shop, so they deal with meat. And I don't remember what leads to this line. Maybe they're talking about traveling or something. Not even important, quite frankly. But I like that the father there says, "Never trust anything that comes from the sea." And I like the dog who's reading just says, "We came from the sea."
Yeah, Peggy tells him that, like, Ed ate some bad clams or something.
That's it. That's right. Yeah. You're right. That's what it was. So after she finishes up there, she heads off to the hair salon where she works. And this is where we really get to really meet her boss, whose name is Constance. I found that out after the fact. Constance kind of chides her a little bit about the fact that it seems like she's going to skip that Life Spring seminar that's going to be next week. You'll recall from last week we were talking about how Peggy is getting into this whole Life Spring thing about, you know, maximizing your potential. All that kind of crap that people really were getting into in the 70s. But her boss thinks she's kind of being held back due to her husband, which is, there's a little bit of truth, but not really, because I think Peggy's really the more dominant figure in that marriage, quite frankly. But her boss also asks her about a missing case of toilet paper, which Peggy seems to claim, you know, ignorance. And I got to say, there was a moment here, and I wrote a question mark, and obviously I didn't need that question mark a little bit later. I wrote down, I could swear her boss was checking out her ass. By the end of the episode, yeah, she was very much checking out her ass. Most definitely she was. We switch back to Lou Salverson, and we find out that he's reversed his original decision on the case. He's clearly on the phone with someone. We don't know who it is, but it's some higher up in law enforcement. Even though we're only hearing half the conversation, kind of like an old Bob Newhart routine or something, I gather that it sounds like he's going to be working with his father-in-law on the case once certain things get sorted out. Which is cool, because I think we want to see those two working together. And I actually like the dynamic of it being like a father-in-law and a younger man. But they get along so well, they could just as easily be father and son. So then we see Mike Milligan and those Beardy twins, who we later learn their names are actually Kitchen. So I guess we can call them the Kitchen Brothers. Well, they visit that typewriter salesman that we saw in the first episode, the guy who was cooking up that scheme with Rai, and which, he's the one who kind of started the ball rolling, which led to that whole bloodbath later on. Well, typewriter guy, because I'll be damned. I can never find the name reference to him in the episode. 5 minutes before our podcast, I finally found out that he, in one place, he's referred to as Mr. Watson on IMDb. But I'll be damned if anyone ever calls him that. So I'm just going to call him typewriter guy. Well, typewriter guy, he tries to play dumb. And that's not going to work with a guy like Mike Milligan. So next, you know, he puts his tie in the typewriter roller, and then he starts. Then he starts to tell a story about how he was once. He was writing a letter to Sears to complain about, I think it was a coffee maker that he had purchased.
Yeah.
So, did you notice, like, I don't know if it quite qualified as a theme or more like a running gag. This is like the second time in the episode we're seeing someone essentially being tortured while an odd little story is being told to them. Huh. Granted, this torture is nowhere near as severe as what Dodd did to that, you know, dead guy. But I just thought it was funny that we've got people who like to talk, which, you know, which is good for us because one of the fun things about the show is the dialogue, I think. The typewriter guy eventually fesses up that he told Rye to talk to a judge. All he did was say to talk, and the judge's name was Munt. At this point, we find out that one of those twins is clearly up on current news, and this is in the day and age of no internet, so that's kind of impressive, I think, because he whispers something to Milligan, who seems to be instantly amused. Did I just hear a kitty cat?
Yeah.
Cool.
They like to hang out and listen during podcasting.
So. Awesome. So Milligan is, again, he seems to be almost amused by the news. I think he even says, "You just told him to talk?" And then they just leave him. They just walk out. So then we go back to the car in the garage at the Blomquist. They play a very interesting piece of music here. It's Burl Ives, who's probably better known for acting and some rather silly songs he did. Wait, is Burl Ives in one of those animated Christmas cartoons? Is he like the talking snowman or something?
He's in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. He's a snowman.
That's where I know from. Here he's singing a song or talking a song. called 1 Hour Ahead of the Posse, which I got a really big kick out of. And while we're hearing that song, Ed is cleaning up the car in the garage, and it's clearly really hard work. You know, he's on his hands and knees with bleach, cleaning up all that blood. And then we see him looking in the opening the freezer and looking at Rye. And as he reaches for him, we then dissolve to, you know, moments or hours later, I don't know, where Ed is standing in front of a raging fireplace. And he's standing in his underwear. Now, I personally want to give the actor some credit here, because either A, he gained a lot of weight for this role, or he just gained a lot of weight but was more than willing to have it all on display here. You know, better man than I, let's put it that way. Now, what was funny is, like, you know, instinctively, I see someone standing in their tidy whities. The first thing I think of is Walter White. You know, and of course, we know this actor already has a Breaking Bad connection to begin with. And of course, considering what he's dealing with, he sure could use one of those barrels of acid right now. It might have made things a lot easier than what he has to go through over the course of the rest of this episode.
Yeah, when during the cleanup scene, I'm just like, oh, you know, this is definitely the kind of guy that probably could handle cleaning up some blood. Because, I mean, I'm sure, you know, at its actual job, that's the kind of thing that he has to do sometimes, like, you know, routinely anyway. But then right. as soon as you open the freezer, I'm just like, oh, I think I know what they're going to do at the end of this episode. I was not disappointed.
it's what he knows. And as that scene closes, I think we have, like, you know, a shit or calves and ankle shot of him. It's clear he's even tossing his underwear in the fire. But we're kind of in a close-up of the fire, and you realize that Rye's clothes are burning, and I believe we were ending on a close-up of that other shoe. So I think his other shoe is burning. So when we come back from the latest break in this longer-than-I-realized episode, we see a little bit, it's not really a montage, but we see a couple shots of Betsy undergoing her chemotherapy, and then Lou, her husband, is driving with Betsy and Molly in the car. We find out that he can't go up to Fargo just yet, and I keep forgetting that some of this is actually going to take place in Fargo. So I was wrong when I kept saying it hasn't actually take place in Fargo. That was my mistake if I said that.
What the fuck is your problem, cat?
I think the cat didn't like me correcting myself. Thank you, cat. Be your own man. But he can't go to Fargo until some chain of command bullshit is ironed out. But, you know, it looks like they have lunch plans, but instead of going to lunch with his wife and daughter, well, he pulls into a restaurant that is most certainly not serving food at this point in time. It's the scene of the crime. It's the Waffle Hut. I like that phrase because I haven't heard this in years. He says he's got a wild hair. So, you know, something's bugging him and he just needs to go check it out. So it looks like Betsy and Molly will be building a snowman while Lulu's checking out the Waffle Hut. And while he's in there, you see him standing over that table where the jug was shut, and he's focusing on something that seems odd and out of place. Namely, it's that can of bug spray. But the real important evidence is discovered outside. And it's not just the fact that Molly, the little girl, finds a little deflated Get Well Soon balloon, but Betsy, when she approaches, find something in the snow under the bushes. It's Rye's gun. I thought it was kind of amusing when Lou comes over and he actually says, oh, it's mommy doing daddy's job for him again. I'm assuming she hasn't found evidence before, but she clearly has always, as I think I even said last week, she seems to be somewhat attuned to his cases and is always there to pipe up with some help. Which, again, actually goes back to season one when we see the Keith Carradine, the older version of Lou, talking about how his daughter takes after her mother. So I like that we're seeing these little elements of it in this season, too. I get a kick out of that. But back to the scene. As Lou is taking the gun from her, he looks up and he slowly watches that Oldsmobile cruise by. That's right. I'm going to get as much mileage out of saying Oldsmobile as I can this spot. And he sees Milligan cruise by, and it's he just knows there's something wrong. You can just tell. I'm assuming it's not because of it's not a racial thing. He just looks like bad news. I think it's more because of the twins in the front, quite frankly.
Yeah, and you know, they're driving slow, and of course they're yeah.
And they seem maybe a little bit out of place, which then. After yet another break, I think we get, I don't know if you'll agree with me on this one. This might have been my favorite scene in the entire episode. It was a surprisingly tense scene, or maybe I shouldn't have been surprised because this is something that Fargo has done well last season, so they're doing it again this season, between Sheriff Larson and Milligan and those Kitchen brothers. Sheriff Larson had pulled his car out into the road, blocking the road. I instantly was wondering, oh, did Lou call ahead? We do find out later, yes, he did. But, you know, he wants to see their license, their registration, their IDs. And because of the brothers not really responding, it kind of annoys the sheriff, as it should, because they're supposed to listen to him. Meanwhile, Milligan is wondering if Rock County was some town in the Flintstones or something. But during this whole scene, I kept going, wait, they wouldn't dare gun down a lawman. Because wouldn't that just be bad business to do that at this point? But I also was thinking, Ted Danson's not the star of this series. So they could easily kill him off. And I would just be like, gah, you know, because I'm not used to seeing Ted Danson, you know, die. You know, that's not usually the parts he plays. But this, the whole back and forth between them, how Mike Milligan's initially screwing with him, and then, I don't know, I wouldn't necessarily say there was an implied threat, but there's this part, which I did not write down, but so I'm actually just trying to remember right now. I wish I'd written it down, because it was probably one of the more better things in the entire episode. When Milligan says that thing about how nice it is, that the two men can have like this calm and rational conversation while everything is just going crazy all around them. Remember what I'm talking about? It was something like that?
Yep.
Yeah. I really love the scene for the tension to see these actors play off each other in a very different way. And, you know, I'm hoping that all these guys make it for at least several more episodes because obviously on this show, and considering how many characters there are, I have no idea how many people may or may not die, you know, sooner than later on this show. You never know. Later that night, we see Ed. He's parked in town, and he's watching his wife accept a lift from her boss. Oh, it was in that moment when the woman, her boss, calls her sexy. That was when I went, ah, so she was checking out her ass. That was a little red flag for me. But Ed's not there for Peggy. He's there to haul a big, huge carcass into the butcher shop after hours. It's Rye's body. Initially, I was thinking, hey, wouldn't the wood chipper have been easier? But then when we see what he actually does, I was like, oh, well, maybe not. So later, Peggy gets home, but her boss needs to take a whiz, so she uses the toilet. And while she's washing her hands, I think she's looking for a towel or something. She opens the cabinet under the sink, and she finds, you know, all those rolls of TP that she was wondering about. And while we hear the great Fats Domino on the soundtrack, it's pretty clear that her boss is totally into her, you know, because she starts talking to her in a certain way, like, oh, you like breaking the rules, don't you? So and all this other kind of, my first thought for whatever reason was, I got a feeling you may end up getting killed off, even if it's by accident. I don't know why, but just the kind of show this is, I can see it happening. It is kind of funny that she leaves before she seems to become even remotely aware of just how awkward a scene she's creating here, because I don't think Peggy's too into it. So we switch back to Lou, and he's sitting in front of the Waffle Hut, and Sheriff Larson arrives, and Lou tells him about that Betsy had found the gun. But just based on that happening, and I remember thinking, wow, what lousy police work. They didn't find the gun that was, like, right there. He kind of points it out himself by saying, you know, he's wondering now what else he might have missed. So I like that they're cognizant and aware of their shortcomings sometimes, which you don't see that happen on a lot of other cop shows. They're just idiots and that's that. At least he's admitting they were not as sharp as they should have been in that situation. That is also when we get the confirmation that he did call Milligan's car in, and that's what led to Larson pulling him over. And so they're talking, and he's basically, we discover that one of the things that's been bothering Lou, it's the appearance of how the cook looked when he saw his body there. I think he says, you know, the cook fell funny. That's the truth, and that's why I'm still here. And it turns out it's reminding him of something else. And Larson, you know, kind of giving a little bit of sage wisdom here. He says, well, things like that, they're called convergence, when one thing reminds you of another. And apparently it reminds Lou of a horrible death that he witnessed in Vietnam 5 years ago. This might be the first time we're hearing that, at least in this season, I should say, that Lou is a Vietnam vet. I don't know if we heard that mentioned in the previous episode. I don't recall it, so I'm going to assume we hadn't heard that before. But then Larson gives his own convergence story. We go back a few more wars to him discovering a Nazi having hanged himself back in World War II. And then, you know, 20-odd years later, on like 1962, he came across a suicide that kind of reminded him of that and kind of left an impact on him. He does make, Larson that is, he does make one rather sad observation, which is very much of the times, you know, this is the late 70s, because you got to remember, 1979, it's only been a few years since people are back from Vietnam, a lot of them, so it's very much fresh in the nation's consciousness at that point. But he points out, at least in that town, after World War II, it was 6 years before there was another murder in that town. That clearly has not been the case post-Vietnam. And he says, you know, sometimes he wonders if you boys didn't bring that war home with you. I don't know. There was something about that line that just had a certain resonance to it that kind of hit home for me, I think. We get another one of those little quick split screen montages. I like that they used them a little bit more sparingly in this episode, so it didn't feel like they were going to that well too many times, which I maybe they might have done in the first episode. I enjoyed it, but I thought maybe they did a little bit too much. And the score, in which I did not point out last week, I just want to mention that there seems to be some sort of typewriter theme going on with Fargo this season. The opening credits are done in a typewriter-like font, and we hear them being typed. Obviously, one of the characters I've referred to already is a typewriter guy, and the initial scheme that leads to all this ruin was about typewriters. And if you listen to the score that they use a few times, including this sequence here, there's a constant little ding, like the bell that goes off on a typewriter when you go to the end of a column. So I don't think that's a coincidence. I think they're doing that on purpose. So it's kind of funny that they're doing that. But with that montage, that's when we see that, oh, Christ, Ed is not just cutting up that body. He is literally putting it through the grinder. I did, for a moment there, I was trying to create some sort of joke because he's putting it through the grinder and it's meat and the guy's name is Rye. There's a sandwich joke in there somewhere. I just couldn't put the words together, but it's pretty horrible. So later we see Lou is driving through town. And I guess the lights being on in that butcher shop must be kind of unusual, because then he pulls over to take a look. Now, he steps out of the car and he knocks, and clearly startling Ed, just when he was about to cut off a hand. So instead he ends up cutting off a few fingers, which go flying.
I laughed out loud when that happened.
Yeah, and I was like, oh no, the fickle finger of fate. they go flying, and one rolls under the door, and you know instantly, okay, that finger right there, that's going to be raising some serious tension in a few minutes. You just know it will. But what's interesting, because we didn't know this beforehand, it turns out Lou knows the Blomquists. You know, he asks about Peggy, and basically the reason why he stopped in, it wasn't so much wondering what was going on because the lights were on. He figured the lights were on. This would be a perfect time for him to get some bacon.
I really like the way they cut the scene too, where like, you know, they just cut to the commercial like as soon as Lou started showing up at the door, and you just knew this, like, oh shit, this is gonna be sweet.
Right, and keep in mind when I'm watching this, it's extremely late at night, so I actually thought that was gonna be the end of the episode. And I was like, they're ending on a little cliffhanger, okay, and then. But the thing with FX shows, whenever it's the end of the episode, you get that stay tuned for scenes from the next Justified or whatever it is. Right. And they didn't do that. And I was like, wait, there's another scene? There's another act? How long is this episode? But I was like, you know, it's just because I was very sleepy. So, yeah, he's going to get some bacon, and that's where the lame joke in our introduction this week derives from that. Because Ed asked him if he wants some fatback style, and he's like, I like it a little lean. And I think about seconds later is when Ed spots that finger. And of course, it's right around the same moment. I think Lou, he drops a coin or something.
Yeah.
So Ed has to kind of scramble to hide that finger. And of course, right at that moment, the phone starts ringing. He was like, are you going to get that? I'm like, yeah, I get it. But yeah,
scenes like this are like, you know, what Fargo really does best, where it's like, you know, definitely a dark comedy, like you said before, but it's still like really fucking tense. Like at the same time, it's like uncomfortably funny. So, yeah. I mean, there aren't a lot of shows or films that can really, that, I mean, you know, percentage wise that can accomplish something like that.
Yeah, I think when we're watching this, it does make me, I think for us especially, it's got a little bit of that Better Call Saul kind of vibe to it when it does stuff like that, because that's the kind of thing they would do on a show like that. You know, they're very much have a certain simpatico kind of feeling, although I think they're going a little bit broader on this show than they have on Better Call Saul.
Yeah, and before we leave the scene too, my stepdad identified the Ed's truck. It's like he says it's like it's a 73 or 74 Ford, which is kind of nice too, just because, like, you know, if you think about it, like, that attention to detail is just nice. Because I mean Ed's working in, you know, part, you know, number two guy in a butcher shop. He's not gonna have a brand new vehicle for, so that's like pretty much the exact like kind of vehicle that somebody that in that position in that, like, you know, part of the state would like be driving. So
right,
it's just kind of like, you know, the fact that they did that and like actually went out and got one, I mean, it's just like a little bit of extra, just like, you know, I always appreciate quality shows when you go the extra mile like that to like not fuck stuff up, but like also to like make it like logical as well. I mean,
right. Was maybe you can ask him as well, because I was curious about this and I didn't take the time to do any freeze framing or pausing on it like I did for some reason with that Oldsmobile. Do we know what kind of car she drives? Because it's a unique looking car, but I didn't really take that close a look at it. I mean, I know it's not an expensive car. I was just wondering what it was.
Yeah, he's a car guy, so I'd have to show him. But I'm sure he'd be identified in like 1 second, because he was just okay. Like, oh, there's that. Oh, there's that. Oh, there's that. So
if we could, we should. I wouldn't mind knowing that, but for our next podcast, just because that obviously that car has played a kind of a major part, and I'm just kind of curious what it is. I mean, I know it's not like a Gremlin or something, but I'm just wondering if it's, you know, is it a Chevy Nova? Is it this? Is it that? I'm trying to think of cars I remember seeing when I was a kid in the 70s that everyone on the block had. So it's funny, like those other guys are driving an Oldsmobile. Oh my God, Oldsmobile is like just one of the most popular cars for the people who had a little bit of money in Brooklyn when I was a kid. You know, Oldsmobiles, you know, Cutlass Sierras, you know, things like that. And the people with a little less money, you know, it was the Dodge Darts the infamous Gremlin, which I actually did not see the Gremlin very much when I was a kid. That's the car I think I heard about more than ever saw. But I'm not Jerry Seinfeld. I'm not a car guy, or Jay Leno for that matter. I don't even know how to drive, so I just got to go by what other people say.
Hi.
So back to that scene, which is actually we're less than a minute or two away from finishing up the episode. Lou is really none the wiser to any shenanigans going on here. So, you know, he leaves while, you know, Ed has picked up the phone and he's talking to Peggy. I think this scene with Peggy kind of made me feel a little bit better about her as far as her her mental state, because she seemed a bit more, for lack of a better way to put it, a bit more normal. You know, she's worried about him. She's feeling a little alone. She doesn't say it, but I got a feeling she might be a little bit more freaked out about her boss than she was about the body sticking out of her windshield. But, you know, at least her reactions seem a little bit more in line with how I think a person would be. Again, the next couple of weeks, she may turn out to be devious, she may turn out to be nuts, I don't know, but at least she seemed like a decent wife and also co-conspirator at this point. But he still has more grinding to do. You gotta finish the deal when you're responsible for manslaughter and a cover-up. I think this would count as manslaughter. So he picks up that finger, and that's at the point we hear this very strange voiceover on the soundtrack. And it took me a minute to recognize it. It's from this weird 70s prog rock album, which was actually a weird retelling of the War of the Worlds kind of. But this track, which goes on for over 9 minutes, because that's how they did it in the 70s, baby, was called The Eve of the War. And that's what's playing as we see Ed getting back to the task at hand. That's right, at hand. And that was the end of Before the Law.
Yeah, so definitely... I thought it was a good episode. Noah Hawley definitely, moved up into that the ranks of, you know, showrunners that direct their own stuff. So I'm sure by the end of season three, he'll be doing the season finale or something. You never know, but
exactly. There is a tradition, and it's a tradition of shows that we've actually covered or discussed heavily, of creators / showrunners then getting into the directing themselves. I mean, obviously, Matthew Weiner, of course. Wait, did I say Weiner? Is it? Oh, I forgot again. Weiner.
It's
I watched the whole thing on YouTube of him correcting someone, and now I forgot. It's Weiner, because he wouldn't want to be called. Yeah, because he talked about why he wouldn't want to be called Weiner. That was it. So Matthew Weiner, Vince Gilligan, so on and so forth. So considering this is his first crack at it, it looked as accomplished as any other episode from last season, as far as I was concerned. You know.
Yeah.
For the series itself, I like that this has built a layer on top of the previous episode.
It was like a setup episode, but like it didn't really feel like it. It was just kind of like actually didn't really even really feel like either of them was like the traditional setup episode. I mean, there was a lot of like moving pieces and stuff like that, but it really hasn't like had the same like, you know, that feel that we're so used to. So it's hard to you know even describe it, but what they're doing is really working well. Just kind of feels natural, and I mean they're taking their sweet time, which is nice.
And one thing I think this show does so well, and I honestly, it's hard for me to think of any other show that does this. It's dealing with two different types of dramatic tension. It's got the slow simmering one that we know is going to build up over the course of the season. As far as the crime family and the corporate business, are they going to go to war, or are people going to die as a result of this? All that kind of thing, and what's going to happen with when the revelation of Rye being murdered comes out, and how you know it's going to be misinformation. You know they're going to assume the wrong person. Crap like that's going to happen. But by the same time, each episode is also featuring tense moments within the episode that are just in those moments, whether it be Ed worrying about the finger when Lou is there. Or that whole great scene between Sheriff Larson and Milligan and his two goons. I mean, I like that you can have both these things working together in the episode. So it means that he's working on all these different levels. It reminds me of, it's like he's, what's that thing with spinning plates? I'm imagining all the plates are on different levels and different, you know, heights of spinning sticks and whatever. And Noah, is it Hawley? Am I pronouncing his name correctly? Is doing a really masterful job of this. And I'm probably going to wait a couple more episodes before I say something which may be a little dickish, but I'm going to say it right now anyway. Let me finish. Oh, actually, if you want to say something, you should say something.
I think I know what you're going to say, but I'll tell you.
Oh, I think you do. I think you do. It's only going to upset one person. Who cares? For whatever reason, maybe because simply they debuted the same year, or maybe because they have an anthology quality to them, or so they will repeat the same characters, generally speaking, for another season, although we are using one, just different ages. I like the first season of Fargo a lot better than the first season of a certain other show that debuted that same year that got probably more hype and notice, even though Fargo won in the end when it came to the Emmys. We are now two episodes into this season, and we're just a few months removed from the sophomore season of that other show. Fargo is killing it. And all the, so part of me was thinking, man, I wish that other show had taken the time to really create characters as interesting and vivid and well cast as this show has been doing so far. And hey, look, so far we've got two episodes, we've got eight more to go. There's so much stuff still to be unpacked, but I'm understanding who everyone is. I'm understanding their connections, and there's complexities here, but I'm not having a problem following anything. And I don't think most people are. Hey, look at that. You can do that. I'm just saying. And they do all that, and they're funny. They do all that, and they're funny. And this episode was more tense than almost anything I saw in that one, except for the big gunfight with just, who's going to get killed? Anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, like, and just, I mean, you know, a big part of it is the way Danson played the scene, just because, I mean, he just kind of looked like, you know, like, oh, you know, oh, shit, I'm in a bad situation here, but also playing it strong. But, you know, I definitely felt like there was a, even though that, like, realistically, if you think it out, they're probably, you know, he'll make it, he'll survive the season. It doesn't really seem like Old Lou would be name-dropping, you know, the Sioux Falls Massacre multiple times if, like, that's where Molly's grandpa got, like, killed. It just seems like the kind
very
of
very good point. Very good point.
And I could be wrong, but I'm just assuming so. But even so, just like, I mean, I thought there was, you know, at least a 50% chance that, you know, he was pretty fucked there. So
yeah, I did too. I kept thinking that's going to be the oh my god moment on the show because, you know, I mean, this is a series that's cast several actors that many of us know from other comedy series over the years. I mean, Brad Garrett. Many of us watched Everybody Loves Raymond. We know him from that. Like I said, Jean Smart, Designing Women, and 24, but, you know, but she has comedic roots. And several other people that we've seen on the show. But I would say if we saw Ted Danson take, like, a shotgun blast to the chest, that would be pretty shocking. You know, yeah. Oh, my God, Sam Malone. And I've seen Ted Danson in a lot of things over the last 20 years post-Cheers. You know, that he's been very good in everything from Curb Your Enthusiasm to Bored to Death to
Damages
being one of the more dramatic, obviously one of the more dramatic roles he's played as opposed to the comedic ones. But I didn't watch him on the CSI show, but I saw one episode. I kind of get what he was on that show, whatever. But this is, I haven't seen him in a part quite like this before, and I'm really enjoying it. And that beard looks really good on him, even.
Yeah.
Also, let me say, you gave him kudos last week, so let me do the same this week. Patrick Wilson, who I never either liked or disliked, always found him to be, he's serviceable. He's somewhat generic as an actor in previous roles that I've seen him in. And I don't mean that too strongly because there's still a chance we might cast him for something. Anyway, I am really liking him on this. I mean, it's like what you said last week about there is certain parts where you can kind of see him just ever so slightly channeling the Keith Carradine performance from season one. Like when he's talking in front of the Waffle Hut, I remember thinking, I was kind of closing my eyes, listening to his cadence of speaking. And I was thinking, oh, he's reminding me of Keith Carradine's portrayal from last season.
But, yeah, and it kind of seems like he's playing a lot of scenes too, where like he's playing it with really strong actors, but like just like the way he's doing it, he's kind of like letting them do their thing, but like not in a way where it makes them seem weak. So it just kind of feels like the entire thing is like elevated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
I think this series so far, and just these two episodes. I mean, there's a lot of shows that have come back that I'm enjoying, that I'm watching right now. Some I'm surprised that I'm enjoying, quite frankly. But this is the one, I'm sorry, that I feel I'm enjoying the most because it's such a different, eclectic, and wild cast that are all doing a great job. And we know we're going to see more. Like, we know we're going to see Nick Offerman show up. And you know that alone is going to be fun. You know, and there's other characters that haven't seen that much of that we'll see more of, so on and so forth. I was never worried about the show coming back. I felt secure, kind of like the kind of thing you say when you feel you're in good hands. But I am still very happy that it's as strong as it is, and that again. We're given a storyline that we find interesting and compelling, and there are several threads that I'm equally invested in, whether it be what's going to happen between with the Gerhardts and the Krauts, so to speak. You know, what's going to happen when Milligan encounters yet someone else? You know, is someone going to get gunned down at some point somewhere? You know, what's going to happen with the Blomqvist? All these different things. When are we going to get to the Sioux Falls Massacre? What does that really entail? Is it the Gerhardts? Or is it the Gerhardts are going to be killed or something? Is it going to be innocent people? I have no idea. I've not read ahead. I don't know if there's spoilers out there. I don't want to be spoiled. But I really love this show.
Yeah, I definitely regret. Oh, and I guess in a way it was nice where I didn't have to wait week to week to watch it last year. But it would have been nice to watch and bask in the glory of it week to week, like with all my friends, since I have like three of them. They all were watching Fargo last year. But and also I'm gonna make a weird prediction for this season. I'm guessing that they're gonna do like a kind of a odd Brave thing, and just because they're so good at producing dramatic tension. But I'm going to predict that at some point in the season they're going to have a scene that's like so like unbelievably tense, and like we're going to be so into it that like Molly, like little girl Molly, is going to be like in danger, and we're actually going to like be worried about it instead of like having time to like stop and like think and just like, no, she's okay. It just seems like the kind of thing like they'd have the balls to try to like pull off and would manage to do it.
That's a good prediction. I like that. You know, there's gonna be. I'm assuming there's gonna be at least a couple major set pieces which will deal with major tension. But I like the idea of it being something where, if you take a step back, well, you know, she's gonna be okay because she's kind of like the star of the previous season. You know, just 25 years or whatever it is younger. But I love when a show or a movie can pull that off where you know full well they're gonna be okay, yet you're still caught up in it. Whether it's Tom Cruise hanging on the side of a building or James Bond or whatever. I always like when a movie or a show can do something like that. So I look forward to seeing what they do here. I'm already, in my mind, I'm already wondering, oh, I wonder what year the third season is going to take place. Is it going to be in between? Are they going to go back another 25 years? All right. So I think we've kind of covered it all. So I think maybe it's time to wrap up so we can start getting ready for our next podcast tomorrow. I still have to watch the darn show before I can even write anything about it. When our little Flash, I got to take care of the Flash, and then everyone got to take care of the Arrow tomorrow.
Just imagine if we could move as fast as Barry, like how much easier our lives would be, how fast we could do all this shit.
I would just need a machine that can play it with dialogue that I could watch with this. Maybe like Susan, our friend Susan, watches and listens to everything at double or triple time so that they're, as you put it, like they're chipmunk versions of our podcasts. Maybe we can do that with these shows.
I can just imagine how ridiculous we must sound like that.
I have heard us, and yeah, a little bit. You especially. No, just kidding.
It's like that episode of the Star Trek, the original series, where like everybody's in like Kirk is like way slowed down with like a hot chick and a bunch of like douchebags, and like everybody's like squeaking like mosquitoes. I'm sure like that's how you and me sound. We don't particularly have deep voices unless we're sick. So I guess.
Oh, by the way, we should. I got a feeling that episode, even though I haven't seen anything yet, that episode of Star Trek should probably be mentioned on our podcast tomorrow, because it reminds me of something I wanted to say, which I don't know if I said it in our previous podcast. But
okay. I will. I'll bring it up.
All right. Well, let's finish this up, because I'm shocked to say that we actually did that in a decent amount of time, but now our rambling is stretching this out a bit. So anyway, if you would like to follow us on the Twitter, we would love for you to follow us on Twitter, because good Lord, I can't seem to get us past 50 followers. So please follow us on Twitter. We are at STVD. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. So it's at STVD Podcast on Twitter. I send out the links. I comment on things every once in a while. Maybe I need to comment more to make it more a cooler Twitter account, but I'm busy. You can also find us and join the conversation on Facebook. We are on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Again, you type in Serious TV Drama, odds are you're going to find us that way. Join the page, and you'll find the page where we talk about everything. Any TV show, even shows that we don't like, we still permit to be spoken about there. Just be aware that someone like me may come in and say, Gotham sucks, or something like that. And finally, best of all, you can find us on iTunes. Again, in the little search box on iTunes, type in Serious TV Drama. That should be enough to find us there. You can rate and review us. A 5-star rating would be awfully sweet. Every rating, every review only helps to raise our profile when people are searching for our podcast about Fargo or about The Flash or about Arrow. By the way, I noticed today that we've actually risen in the ranks for all three. We actually come up pretty high in the Fargo. If you search for our Fargo podcast or Fargo TV podcast, we come up pretty high there. I was pretty pleased to see that. But of course, you can subscribe to us there as well. We have no way of ever knowing how many subscribers we have because apparently technology can do everything else, but it can't tell us how many subscribers we have. But it's nice to know that we have.
It's like an Apple, they won't even tell like mark there.
So. Dan, curse because that might raise your audio. you were so good for the whole podcast. Now you've kind of become Little Voice. It's like Ant-Man. No one can hear you. Or maybe smack your microphone or your phone or whatever it is. Oh, there you go. I hear you now.
Okay.
Nope, now there you are.
Whatever. Let's go to bed. It's been fun.
All right. Good night, everybody. See you soon.
Good night.
See you soon. I'm not going to see anybody. That was ridiculous. Speak to you soon, maybe. Anyway, good night.
Good night.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Some crazy little